Back together with you Friday, May 28th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. What's it like to get a phone call asking for your help to find someone missing in the Middle East? We spoke to a gentleman who grew up in the diplomatic community. He's been doing that for the past few years in Syria and the surrounding area. We got a call from a Bridgeport Town Republican official to chat about some past ballot funny business in the Park City. Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield chimed in, giving us a wrap-up of a very busy week at the state capitol, and I had a few thoughts regarding a bill co-sponsored by Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy that would affect possibly college sports in the U.S.
I have to talk about this because, to me, there's nothing worse than when politicians just pander and don't stay in their lane and start to pontificate about stuff that I am sure they have no idea in which they're talking about. What do I mean? And again, I have no personal animus with Senator Chris Murphy. I've never met the man. I've never spoken to him. I have spoken to Mr. Blumenthal on numerous times. I've known him for the years. I used to have more congressional members on my show, but it's useless because they're only going to use a show to say what they're going to say and never will change their minds. This one popped into my feed here, and I know Melissa was talking about this morning, but I got to talk about this because this is so tone deaf. It's mind numbing. Chris Murphy and Bernie Sanders, so that should tell you something right there. Chris Murphy and Bernie Sanders introduce a Senate bill that would allow college athletes to unionize. On Thursday, Senators Chris Murphy and Bernie Sanders introduced the College Athlete Right to Organize Act, a bill that would give a bigger voice to college athletes. Representation through a union. This, by the way, in Forbes. Now, hang out with me, kids, here. It gets better. Chris Murphy said in a press release, big-time college sports haven't been amateur for a long time, and the NCAA has long denied its players economic and bargaining rights while treating them like commodities. Really, Senator? They've denied them economic rights. That's kind of interesting because the last time I checked, and on and off through my 40-something years, 38 years, 35 years, whatever it is in this business, I've covered college athletics to the point where I worked for an athletic department. I covered them in a newspaper, too. And one thing that I, Senator, with all due respect, have come to realize that players get paid. They get paid. They get an economic reward for what they're doing. It's called a scholarship. It's called free tuition. It's called free room and board. It's called medical training staffs. It's called, generally on a lot of campuses, better housing than some students, better meal plans, things like that. A lot of stuff that the average person doesn't know about. Chris Murphy said, I'm introducing the College Athlete Right to Organize Act, which will finally recognize college athletes as employees. Really? And allows athletes to collectively bargain with their colleges and across conferences. Is he nuts? Seriously. Did he, like, have a bad piece of meat or something? Having the right to do so will help athletes get the pay and protections they deserve and forces the NCAA to treat them as equals rather than second-class citizens. Here comes the racial attitude. It's a civil rights issue. You see what Chris Murphy's doing here? Yeah, I hope, you know, most NCAA football and basketball players at major schools are black. They're African American. So put in the race issue here. You know, I read this and I hearken back. It's one of the two. And not that they're interchangeable, but they do goof with one another, and they're both in the news. Either Charles Barkley or Shaquille O'Neal, and you know they had their shtick on the TNT NBA show. I believe it was Charles Barkley who said about a month or two ago, and he has said this over and over again throughout the years, because, you know, Charles doesn't care what he says, and God bless him, because about 80 or 90% of the time he's right, and he says stuff that other people don't want to hear. And I'm kind of paraphrasing what Barkley said. He kind of said, what is it with people not understanding that college athletes are getting, if it's a D1 or D2 school, Division III does not have athletic scholarships. You know, Charles Barkley said a few months ago, what is it with people who don't consider a full scholarship for 4 years? How do you not consider that getting paid? Folks, I'm telling you. And listen, this is a cheap political stunt. We all know what Chris Murphy puts in there. It's a civil rights issue. Come on, please. Again, when in doubt, and you're a Democrat, use race. And that's quickly being almost superseded now by the transgender issue, but race is still number one. Look, folks, listen, look. You know what? Let's do traffic and weather together here, because I got to state stuff that should be obvious, one of which is that politicians of either party, of either stripe, either on the state or local level, or national level, they need to just stay in their lane, especially when they probably have very little understanding of how an athletic department works, of what sports make money, what sports don't make money, what sports are affected by Title IX, and all that. One of our two U.S. Senate members, Chris Murphy, has teamed up with Bernie Sanders to introduce a law that would let college athletes form unions. The College Athlete Right to Organize Act would allow college athletes to get paid, form unions. Just. And of course, because Chris Murphy said it's a civil rights issue, wink, wink, knock, knock, when we say civil rights. You know, listen. Look, again, no personal animus toward Senator Murphy. I don't besmirch him for the position he has, but he's just wrong on this. And when members of Congress weigh in on stuff like this, they just show a frightening lack of understanding as to what goes on in college. Number one is, again, other people have said, these athletes at Division I and Division II schools, they get paid. It's called a scholarship. And at most big-size, marquee-size schools, between tuition, room, board, and fees, and if you've just, like me, put somebody through college, along with his mom, my son, a few years ago, and you've had grandkids or sons, daughters go through college or in college right now, you know that over a quarter, that's about over 4 years, roughly anywhere from 170 or 180 grand up to about $250,000. So the notion purported by, you know, politicians and everyone, well, these poor athletes, they're performing in front of 60, 70,000 people a week, and they don't get paid. Yes, they're getting paid. They're getting what's known as a free education, which about 95% of them are going to have to fall back on when they don't make the NBA or the WNBA or the NHL or Major League Baseball or the NFL. So, yes, college athletes get to go there free. I know for some members of Congress, especially on the Democratic side, the theory of something free may not translate into money, but when it's free, That means they're getting something that other people have to pay upwards of $250,000 for. And then the argument by people like Bernie Sanders and Chris Murphy, well, they're employees of a school. Well, yeah, welcome to America. So what's the difference between what they're doing as college athletes, which they've been doing for their lives if they're playing sports on a Division I or Division II level? They've been doing this all their lives, so they are taking what they are talented at. They're getting a free education, and they are applying their skills to a much bigger entity, to a university or a conference. Welcome to America, kids, because a lot of people in that class that are not elite athletes are going to be doing the very same thing when they graduate and start making 50, 60, 70 grand for a company that's worth $1 billion or more. So again, what's the difference? And again, this idiotic College Athlete Right to Organize Act is apparently going to pertain to public universities. Okay, so UConn, you know, state schools, essentially. So what happens then when a public university versus a private university, for instance, Notre Dame or Stanford or something like that, or Duke, is recruiting that same athlete? And they say, well, hey, you know, you would have to become a union member there. Come to our school. We're still a great D1 national program, and you don't have to be in a union. I love this part of it. It provides that the National Labor Relations Board shall recognize multiple schools within a conference as a multi-employer bargaining unit. This is lunacy. Do people really think this would improve college athletics? You know, it's bad enough they're going to start to have this name, image, and likeness rule, which would allow individual players to cut endorsement deals with local businesses. Okay, that's fine. All these college commissioners, Val Ackerman said it for the Big East the other day. She's like, we have no idea how this is going to play out. She's like, this could be chaos. I forgot the word she used. I'll look it up on the break here. But the fact that now these individual athletes are going to be able to cut out and cut deals, great, good for them. What happens when the top five on a team all get brand new SUVs and the bench warmers have squat, as they used to say? But again, it's a civil rights issue, like Chris Murphy says. Folks, I'm sorry. I've been around college and high school athletics all my life. This is pure lunacy. But again, this is a tactic by Chris Murphy and by Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren is in on this, too. You try and cultivate young Democratic voters, right? By saying, God, you're playing football at the University of Michigan. You're on national TV every week. There's 80,000 people watching you at Michigan Stadium, or 100,000. And you're getting a free 4-year education. Oh, you're being so taken advantage of. Come here. We'll give you a big hug. And we continue right here on Connecticut Today on WICC 600 on the radio and online at WICC600.com. Back to open phones momentarily. First, though, you know how I love to have authors who write really neat books on the show, particularly the books that kind of interest me, politics, intrigue, true-to-life stuff. Joining us right now is Daniel Levine. His new book is called Proof of Life, 20 Days on the Hunt for a Missing Person in the Middle East. It was released a few days ago this month on May 18th of 2021. Daniel Levine, hi, it's Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
And Daniel, thanks for the time. We appreciate it. Boy, the accolades for this book sound pretty cool. And this is a true story, is it not?
It is. This is a true story. These are events that happened over 20 days in late 2014. Yep.
And now you were born into the diplomatic realm, right? I believe your parents or your dad was a diplomat.
That's correct. I was born in 1963 in Israel. My father was an Israeli diplomat. We ended up being posted in East Africa and Kenya, all over East Africa. And so I grew up as a little boy in the 60s, really just traveling from place to place, then went back to Israel in the late 60s, and then moved to Switzerland, where my mom's from, and all over the place, really. I've lived in places in Europe, in the Middle East, and for the last few decades in the U.S.
So being a citizen of the world then was really almost second nature to you then, growing up with different cultures and being exposed to different people.
Yeah, citizens of the world or a citizen of nowhere. It kind of goes hand in hand. You know, you're comfortable in different places, but you're not really rooted anywhere.
Okay, so the basis of this book. Now, one day, I guess, what were you doing when your phone rang here and all of a sudden the wraps are taken off on this, as you say, this wild situation for a few weeks? How did this all begin?
So take a step back. Starting in late 2011 and 2012, I run a foundation in Europe, and we had tried to mediate in the Syrian conflict essentially by taking some young people from all the fighting parties out of the country and trying to prepare them for leadership positions so that when the killing would stop, we'd have a core group of people who could work together, and it wasn't just from one side to the war. Mm-hmm. At the time, this was before Russia intervened in the war and tipped the war in the favor of the current regime of Assad. At the time, it really wasn't clear, and this was also before the huge Islamist resurgence in Syria in 2014. So there was some hope in that kind of a project. And as a result of that work, we were approached quite a few times by families and media organizations of people who had gone missing in Syria, journalists, aid workers, sometimes adventurers, to see if we could get any information or had them, and in some instances also try to negotiate their release. And so because this had happened and I had been involved in 2012, 2013, that's the background for this request that came to me in 2013. I should add, I had just had a pretty painful failure of trying to get proof of life on a different person just shortly before this request. So I really did not want to get involved in that kind of a thing in Syria again when this person approached me.
Was it the fact, Daniel, that you were angry? Did you think you had failed? Did you think you had enough here that it would be too painful to try again?
Yeah, it's. I mean, these are all really horrific situations. You're first of all dealing with families that are heartbroken. No matter what the reason is that a person got taken hostage in Syria, it's always a heartbreaking situation, and most of these situations don't have happy endings. And this request had come really very, very shortly, right after these gruesome beheadings of some journalists, of James Foley and Stephen Salaf and others. And so the war had just become, had just added up a few levels of violence that we hadn't really imagined. And my prior experience, I'd been misled by a number of people, and I was disappointed and very upset by the fact that I wasn't able to give these families any kind of relief. And so, yeah, it does feel like a personal failure. Even if the odds are stacked against you, you obviously always hope against hope that you can help.
The name of the book is Proof of Life, 20 Days on the Hunt for a Missing Person in the Middle East. More with the author, Daniel Levine, coming up first. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And continuing right here on WICC 600 on the radio and online at WICC600.com. New book out, came out just a few days ago, Proof of Life, 20 Days on the Hunt for a Missing Person in the Middle East. Daniel Levine continues to be with us for a few minutes. You know, when people in my business, Daniel, the news, the talk business, radio, television, newspapers, they hear the terms missing person and Middle East, and a lot of us sit back and go, wow, wouldn't want to be there, wouldn't want to be looking for them. You get this request, we don't want to give away too much of the book, but when you get a request like this, and you said you dealt with this before, do you have standard channels you work? What are the first things you do to try and, as you say, find proof of life?
Well, in the case of Syria, if I have any inkling of which group might have taken this person, it could be a secular rebel group up in the north. It could be an Islamist group in the northeast of the country, in Raqqa, or it could be the regime in the coastal region or in Damascus. And depending on who the group might be, if I have any kind of information, it's going to change who I'm going to contact first. There's one very dear friend of mine who is born to a Saudi father and a Syrian mother, a very influential individual in the region whom I identify in the book, who really helped me through this, and he's usually the first person I contact. And there have been instances, for example, if there was any information that the negotiation of ransom payment is involved, where I don't touch the matter. So there are a number of simply no-goes for me. That's just one example. And so, or if I know that the case has been made too public already, I know full well how much harder it is to do anything when a case has been made public. So there are a number of situations, but generally I have three people I would initially contact. This one person whom I identify in the book, Khalid Al-Maghi, is the first person I usually contact. And he was the person here, too, and I asked him whether he could, whether he had any such information, anything about this person. And he called me back and told me that that there was a trail, and for me to be able to pursue this trail, I'd have to fly to Istanbul first to meet him. And then if he got the green light, that I would travel to Beirut to meet one of the, let's call them political/warlords in Beirut,
wow,
who would then basically send me to the next station on the trail. So at every stop in this process, you kind of have to assess whether, first of all, this is trustworthy and the information is reliable, and secondly, whether you're safe, of course, whether it's okay to keep on pursuing it.
Well, sure. I was going to just mention, I would imagine that you're always encountered or always dealing with, Daniel Levine, this aspect hanging over your head, is it safe? I mean, what am I doing here? And number two, I'm wondering if governments ever get to you or you inquire of them and they say, hey, Daniel, back off on this one. We know you're good at this, but you can't dip your toe in this one.
Yeah, I do get contacted by governments. It's usually, it's not so much can you find and negotiate the release of this person, but rather, the families of this missing person have contacted whatever, the White House or Downing Street in London or the Élysée at the Palace in Paris. They're all really distraught, and we're trying to get as much good information as we have through your networks. Do you have any? And then depending on circumstances, I end up working closely, usually with intelligence communities in those countries. But it really varies. Most of the cases I get contacted by the families, and usually, unfortunately, because they get frustrated that the government's unwilling to help them. And that, in turn, depends also on the circumstances in which this person marched into Syria. So if we're talking about an adventurer who just wanted to figure out what it really looks like in there, the governments are going to say, we post travel warnings not to go there all over the place. You can't go into Syria legally. If you decide to pay someone in Turkey to walk you across the border, that's on you. Don't expect us to put people at risk and spend tremendous resources, let alone a ransom payment, because you took that risk. And so those are heartbreaking discussions. And you can imagine when you're talking to the parents or the children or the spouses of those who've gone missing. So there are a number of people who end up being active trying to execute this because the governments don't officially want to do it. Unfortunately, there are also a lot of mercenaries and charlatans in this area.
The name of the book, once again, Proof of Life, 20 Days on the Hunt for a Missing Person in the Middle East. A couple more minutes here with author and the guy who's involved in this, Daniel Levine. So, Daniel, because you are not directly connected to a government in this situation, and because you pick and choose your spots, do you engender at all, Daniel, a level of trust or a level of openness or channels that may be a consulate or an embassy or somebody in the regular diplomatic corps would not be able to take advantage of?
This is not a statement that they're somehow not capable of doing it. They're, you know, as you say, they're horses for courses, and every situation calls for a different type of network or relationships or skill set. So this is not some kind of official-to-official negotiation where you can have an ambassador in Lebanon call the foreign minister asking him to connect him to Damascus and have a formal request. Whenever that does happen, this doesn't go anywhere, because in the case of kidnapping, either there are little militias that demand ransoms, or if the governments have them, they deny having them. And so the formal process simply doesn't lead anywhere. So governments and intelligence communities also rely on individuals who have those relationships. Now, it's not that I'm just roaming those areas trying to build up my network. Mm-hmm. There's a context for my work there, which is the work of this foundation. And that's a very public work where we're working with groups on the ground, sometimes with governments, trying to rebuild these failed states, some of them in war zones, some of them countries that are just tremendously poor, and we're trying to rebuild their political systems or their economies. And so there is a very formal, visible, official context for my presence in those places. This sounds perhaps a whole lot more shady than it is, but as a result of that work, you build up over years and decades a network that can be helpful, you know, when this moment comes to pass, when you really need to call on friends.
Finally, Daniel, the situation, this is in a backdrop of what's going on in Syria and what's going on, been going on there for years with different input from the U.S., from Russia, from all these external actors. The situation there, does it make it especially difficult because of the unrest there and the relative instability of Syria? And you've got a strong man there in Assad who is, you know, constantly trying to maintain his power. Is it especially tough in that area?
It is. I mean, you know, it's very, very medieval in the sense that the brutality of the war there is something you're never really quite prepared for. And so you can't just travel around Syria thinking that you're going to be able to collect information. There are vast parts of the country that for me are no-go. There are parts I do go and I have been to many times over the last years. But you have to be aware of what you can and cannot do. But the hardest part is not so much where you can travel. The hardest part is whom you can trust. And that relates to both your own safety, first of all, and secondly, the quality of information you get. For every helpful nugget of information, I have to go through 50, 100 different conversations that are completely useless. And so the skill you try to develop is how do I deploy an effective filter so I can separate the misleading information, the deliberately false information and the rumors from something that is really reliable. And that's the hardest part.
And Daniel, thank you for your work and continued good luck. Name of the book, Proof of Life, 20 Days on the Hunt for a Missing Person in the Middle East. The author, Daniel Levine. Daniel, thank you. Once again, good luck. Stay safe. And hopefully we can chat down the line, sir. Be good.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Before the Bridgeport Republican Town Chair, Deputy Registrar of Voters, Anthony Mignotolo, back with us. Anthony, Paul here. How are you, sir? How you been?
How you doing? Listen, you know what? I just wanted to, clarify something.
Sure.
Once and for all. We keep hearing about the ballot shortage and what happened at Bridgeport.
Okay.
And I want to set the record straight.
Go right ahead.
The school that we were short ballots was Central High School. Okay, and what happens is in Central High School, we have two different districts. One is significantly, it's a lot bigger than the other district.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was when they had gone to order the ballots, they ordered for the wrong district.
Oh.
Because I was the moderator, in fact, that night at that school.
Geez.
And I was in the smaller district.
Yeah.
And when I opened up my cage in the morning to take out my ballots, I says, why do I have so many ballots?
Oh,
they should have been for the other district, which was on the other side, because it's a school that has two polling places.
Okay.
And the other thing I want to mention is that on that day, there were 11 other towns that ran out of ballots.
Oh.
And we've never heard about any of the other towns,
you know,
and
why.
You know, we're kind of like, you know, it's Bridgeport, and that's why it was such a big deal. But it was a simple mistake, and since then, we order 100%
nice.
Ballots.
Good, excellent, excellent.
You know, we throw too many away, but now, I mean, we can't go through that
Anthony, wait a minute, what are you throwing them away for? You should autograph them and sell them on eBay or something, or sell them in You like that, huh? See that?
I like that.
You
one.
Autograph them, get the mayor to autograph them, pass them all around the city. Somebody will buy them, right?
Okay, Paul, just real quickly, I just want to mention one other thing.
Sure.
When we talk about the absentee ballots and how the voting works.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we have here in Bridgeport, we have a lot of senior housing.
Yep.
And we have a lot of places that are either senior and disabled housing. And what happens is that the machine here in Bridgeport, what they do is they send all their people out there, and they know exactly when they're going to get their ballots, and they go in there to supposedly help these people to vote. And it's a scare tactic. And what they do is they tell these people, well, if you don't vote for our candidate, especially when they have a when there's a primary on their side, they're saying, well, if you don't support our thing, you're going to lose your apartment. And, and this is what they do to the seniors and stuff. And that's what's wrong with absentee ballots.
Yeah.
As far as it comes to the cities.
Now, Anthony, isn't that, I don't know what the answer is. I'm just asking you. You may want to defer to an attorney here. But doesn't that fall under ballot harvesting where people go out and just collect all these ballots? Or am I wrong here?
You know what? That's exactly what it is,
okay.
And it should be illegal. In fact, what we're trying to push for now is we have what's called supervised absentee balloting, where we go to a handful of the senior houses. And what we do is we send people from each party out there, and we help the people vote. The people that want to sign up for the absentees, then we go back, they have privacy booths, and we let people vote who they want to vote for. But the problem is we have so many places here in Bridgeport, and our budget is limited. So, but what we're pushing for is to be able to go into all the senior housing and all the disabled housing places and not let these people, it should be against the law. And I just became a member of the state party, and I'm going to be pushing those Republicans.
Good.
We need to make this a law that these people should not be allowed in there. I've heard people in City Hall say, oh, they're on their phone. Oh, great, you got your absentee ballot. Well, I'll be over there after work so I can help you vote. I mean, come on, it's ridiculous.
I've been told, Tony, and I was told this, I think, a couple of years back, by somebody from the League of Women Voters or some organization who said, in that kind of a situation, isn't there supposed to be one representative from one party and another representative from the other party, in other words, the Democrat and Republicans, on site, as you said, when people are doing this, right? That's what I was told.
Yeah, you know what? We have about six or seven places that we go into. The problem is here in Bridgeport, we probably have over 20.
Yeah.
So they get into those places where there is not supervised absentee balloting. And what we're pushing for is to get into all of those places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need a little money, you know, to help us out to be able to do this, because obviously, like, we have to pay these people that go out there and do that.
Yeah.
But that would go a long way into helping a lot of the fraud that's going on.
Well, Anthony, good to hear from you. Thanks for calling, and I'm glad that the absentees have been taken care of, or the ballots, rather. I'm sorry, so you don't have
that's not going to happen again.
And like I said, the ones that you don't use, I'm telling you, autograph them, send them to the mayor's office, the police department. Somebody will buy them, Anthony. Trust me, somebody will buy them.
Yeah, we can send them down to West Virginia so we can have our ex-police chief sign
them. Anthony, thanks. I appreciate it.
Take
it easy. Oh, West Virginia, a little shot there. There you go. That's hockey parlance, folks. That's called a face wash. A little shot as you're skating away. All righty, kids, one more big juicy plump hour to go here on Connecticut Today at 507, almost 508, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC is the number. When we get back to open phones, once again, Yankee baseball coming up 6:30 tonight, pregame 7:10, first pitch, Yankees in Detroit. So we'll see how they bounce back after losing 2 out of 3. To Toronto. Man, things are going hot and heavy, as they usually do toward the end of the session of the General Assembly in the odd number years. Those are the non-election years, so that's where you see a lot of laws made, corrected, killed, or whatever. Let's see what is going on still to be done, what has happened as we speak. Republican Fairfield State Senator Tony Wong is joining us on the show. Tony, it's Paul. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Paul. Happy Friday to all, and wishing everybody a safe and thoughtful Memorial Day weekend.
Boy, it's been a crazy week at the Capitol, Tony. Let's go over some things here just to get people up to steam. The zoning bill. Now, I guess that has cleared. It wasn't as extreme as people feared, Tony. It will allow some people to do some things, from what I understand, and allow municipalities to bow out. Am I reading this right?
Well, it's an interesting perspective. Ultimately, it changes a nearly 100-year law as it relates to planning and zoning. And to me, my biggest concern to this, Paul, is it, in essence, codifies the fact that the state has the right and prerogative to dictate to local municipalities on the area of planning, zoning, and land use. That's what this bill did last night in our debate, that literally home rule in our local municipalities and the concept of true local planning control and planning input is hanging by a thread. Despite whatever the spin may be from the majority Democrats who have been such a strong advocate of this bill, this changes the dynamic and codifies the fact that the state truly owns the right and prerogative in telling your local municipalities how they should design, build, and use their land in the way. That's what's deeply troubling for me on this bill.
So from what I understand, Tony, the way the bill has been formed and from what I've been able to read here, and I've had other people tell me this, it almost seems that the forces behind this bill are trying to take a little now in saying, well, we'll let cities or towns opt out of this. We'll give them, you know, some scraps here. But it sounds like they may be back for seconds here, maybe next year or the year after.
Without a doubt, it really is the camel's nose under the tent. This was a combination of some compromises and a softening of nearly 12 to 15 bills that were offered this year in the General Assembly in various elements and extremes in regards to zoning changes, housing initiatives. And indeed, it was a softening and it was, quote, a compromise. But as I said in the beginning, Paul, this bill codifies the fact that the state has the right and prerogative to tell communities and individuals' personal property rights that they know better. And this is indeed a potential opening for the next step. And as I said, local planning, home rule is hanging by a thread by this ruling, and it really is incremental. And what this bill did, Paul, was it took a combination of all the numerous nuances of bills offered in the committee and stuck it in a kind of relatively innocent bill in a strike-all amendment. So it was a brand new bill that was slapped into another that we've all been debated and discussed in committee to a form that it literally is a brand new bill with all the elements in it. But you're right, Paul. This is truly an opening in the crack. And I think people should be fully aware of it, despite the spin that Democrats may say, this actually gives our towns more power in being able to reject the state's prerogative. My answer to them is the towns are doing quite fine.
Yeah.
And the last time the state tried to do something in a well, noble, and intentioned effort was to pass a law nearly 30 years ago called 830G for the better intention of affordable housing. And my discussions during the debate was, how did that work out? How did that affect people's home property and communities and the local input? It's created tremendous turmoil and not met the goal of increasing affordable housing stock in our state.
Tony Wong is the guest. Now let's go to the clean slate bill. Tony, interesting. It got through the Senate, your chamber, with, even though there was some rather pointed debate about things, you know, some offenses that would be, you know, basically expunged from people's records after a certain time that were actually felonies, but it got some pushback in the House and now is in the process, I guess, of being amended or voted on again. Where does that stand? And were you, Tony, at all surprised that this got the amount of blowback it did in the House?
it was not a surprise at all, Paul. In our debate in the Senate, Senate Republicans proposed a number of amendments to take out some of the egregious bills. And in my debate deliberation, I talked about concerns raised by domestic violence advocates on the releases of individuals guilty of stalking and potential domestic violence and sexual assault. These people should not have their slates removed, because I talked about victims and families living in terror and trauma for the rest of their lives, and an individual who perpetrated that would have their slate cleaned without any record. So we Republicans offered amendments that were valid and concerning various crimes that were too egregious, too dangerous to clear off of individual slates. There are other misdemeanors which we had no problem in agreement with, and if the Democrats in the Senate had agreed to these amendments, it would have had true bipartisan passage of that. But nevertheless, the arrogance of one-party rule, they had the numbers, the Senate Democrats, and they ran it and ignored our amendments, and they passed that bill out of the Senate. And lo and behold, when people start realizing that some of the crimes that were cleared on the slate that were going to be wiped off from potential criminals' records, people reacted. The House literally said, Democrats and Republicans said, these crimes should not be cleared from the books. These individuals, indeed, if they paid their price, but the public should know some of the severity of those crimes and be able to hold them somewhat accountable. So as a result, in a unique twist, we took another bill and passed out the clean slate, removing some of the same very egregious crimes that we offered as Republicans in the amendment, passed it out, and then the House took on a fresh new bill. And the reality for me summing it up is this: one-party rule and arrogance is bad policy making.
Tony, hang on.
You can't make this stuff up, right?
No, I know. And I was reading about this weird flip-flop where instead of going back to the Senate, it was tendered in the House again, and that made my eyes explode. Tony, hang on. I'm going to be right back with you. When we come back with Tony Wong, we're going to talk about something that we talked about earlier in the show, which now is going to at least start the process of maybe bringing in early voting in the state. First, though, traffic and weather together, 516. Open phones later on WICC. All right, a lot of stuff going on at the state capitol as we get near the end of the legislative session that could and will affect you and your families and your businesses and all that down the road. Republican Fairfield State Senator Tony Wong with us for a few more minutes as we head into this Memorial Day weekend. So, Tony, I see now that there will be a question on the 2022 ballot asking people if it is in a sense, Tony, I guess, okay to unlock the door here of the state constitution and perhaps at least in 2022. I know the absentee ballot question would be 2 years after that, Tony, but perhaps open the process here to instituting early voting in the state. I know there's some questions, though. Once we get after that, what are the parameters of early voting going to be? So I guess the first step, Tony, here, correct me if I'm wrong, is that this election question next year would have to get approved, right?
It would have to be approved by referendum. And the concept of early voting is allowing the legislature by a simple majority, which was one of the big questions I had. I had really requested and offered the idea of a two-thirds majority of the legislature before we enact any policy related to early voting. But nevertheless, this referendum cites only a majority of the legislature. So it is a majority party dictate. But the reality is, there is no real definitive format or policy as it relates to early voting. It is really an allowance that now we can explore the idea of early voting, maybe not as early as what Oregon has, but to be able to explore different perspectives of early voting through a legislative process and Committee of Cognizance and public hearing to make a decision. But it is ultimately up for a public referendum, and it is a more a flexible and a different way of saying how we can create approaches and legislative policies to engage more active voting. But I will share with you that there were some opposition, but at the same time, my concern was perhaps not just a simple majority, but a two-thirds to have a more of a reflection of a higher threshold. But nevertheless, it did pass, and it was bipartisan. And it is very important to note that the Connecticut General Assembly, in a bipartisan effort, did this, and that we are not Georgia. And we are, we do need to take the necessary paths and safeguards to ensure, you know, integrity and safety in voting. But we are also receptive to different ways to increasing voter participation as well.
I actually thought it was quite refreshing, Tony, and I mentioned that earlier today that, you know, Connecticut, which does not have initiative and referendum, and you and I both know that, we're one of the 11 states that doesn't, you know, it's going to be refreshing, I think, to at least have the people, Tony, a year and change from now, in November of 2022, let them have a little bit of a direct say in such an important issue here.
Absolutely. And we had such a referendum, Paul, related to early voting on a constitutionality change, because we are one of the few states in the country that does have limitations on absentee ballot voting. So that was actually a referendum ballot nearly 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And because of some confusion and phrasing and maybe some onerous kind of flexibility, which I did raise a concern about when I was on the Government Administration Elections Committee, it failed. It failed by the vote of the voters on the referendum for early absentee voting, as well as early voting initiatives. So this has been tried before, but I think that the mood and the context has significantly changed. Post-COVID and the idea of increased participation of voters.
Tony, thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Have a great weekend, Paul. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Republican State Senator Tony Wong Fairfield. There you go. So, yeah. So come a year from this November, you will get to vote in the state here in the November of 2022 elections, not this November, whether or not you would okay the General Assembly to, you know, sniff around, take a look at the possibility of doing early voting here in the state. How about that?